And want to say welcome one, welcome all to the Jumbo Braille program here on the Six Eyes Radio Network, the one and only program here on the Six Eyes Radio Network that can be felt. This is Missionary Kenneth Wolfgang, better known as Big Dot, with you on another Thursday night program, saying welcome one, welcome all, especially our surrounding city and states and our countries near and far, as well as those who've called 424-243-9617. Again, 424-243-9617. Press the number one, join the conversation. You can ask your questions, give your comments, or any of those good things. So, we got with us Ghost Dot, Sister Ruth.
Well, we got the Father, Son, Holy Ghost band of angels. It's sure crowded, but we don't see them, but we know they're there. We have Jim, Six. We have Brother Quick and somebody else I don't know.
Okay, just give the error code and first three numbers of that unknown number.
216-581.
Okay. That may be our mystery guest there. Six, is that your mystery guest that you was going to have in tonight?
No, believe it or not, that is Mama Six Eyes. Welcome, Mama. Amen.
All right.
Hi, Mama.
So is your mystery guest not going to be able to make it in tonight?
No, we'll have to catch it with her later. I gave a call, but I didn't get an answer.
All right, well then we'll just go ahead and get right into our program tonight. What we was going to have for a program tonight, everybody who is familiar with gospel music is familiar with the gospel songwriter P.P. Bliss. Well, 145 years ago, there was a great train accident in Ashtabula, Ohio, known as the Ashtabula Horror or the Ashtabula Bridge Disaster. And this tonight will be part one talking about that great Ashtabula train disaster, railroad disaster, where P.P. Bliss was on that passenger train, the number 5 train, and where he was killed along with many others in that train disaster. And we're going to learn what happened during that disaster, what caused the disaster, and more importantly, what some of the survivors had to say so that we could get a better understanding of what went on back 145 years ago. We're going to get right into it tonight, but just before we do, has anybody else heard about this disaster?
Not to you say anything about it. I know I lived in Ashtabula, and my mom is from Cognac. So she was out there, when she was little going to school. But somebody had said something had happened in Ashtabula, but they never said, and they said it was a book talking about something that happened in Ashtabula. So now, talking with you, it's this train disaster. So here we go.
Yeah, the Ashtabula Disaster by Stephen Peet is the author of the one book, and the other one is Bliss and Tragedy, but I forget the author, but you can look them up in the Ashtabula Library, and they let me take the two books out, so you guys might have fun looking at them.
So those were the reference material we used, and also there was a book that Tim uses on Tuesdays that talks about different hymn songwriters and the songs that they do. And there's this song, It Is Well With My Soul, which Spafford wrote the words while P.P. Bliss wrote the music for it. And that was the song that was found on the train in his baggage. And so that will be also a part of what we'll be having during this three-part series. So with that, I think what we'll do is get started and get into our information tonight.
Well, it sounds good. Get your popcorn and drink. Let's enjoy.
And say hi to Brother Quick. He's listening in tonight.
Hello, Mama. How you doing?
Hi. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Mama. How you doing, sweetheart?
I'm great, thank you. And yourself, Boozy?
I'm doing fine. It's just that I'm kind of glad this year's ending. I think we're going to have better luck or better blessings from God next year, so I'm getting excited about the end of the year and coming into a new one.
Amen.
Amen. And Brother
All right,
Quick,
so
this is my... Brother Quick.
Go ahead, Zix.
Yeah, I wanted to introduce Brother Quick to my mom, but I don't know where he's at.
Oh, I
I'm
put
right
him
here.
On mic if you guys wanted to say hi for a little bit. I got Brother Quick here.
Right. How you doing, sir? Good evening.
I'm doing wonderful. How you doing, Brother Six Eyes?
I'm doing great, sir, doing great. Just wanted to introduce you to the one that started it all. That's my mom. And, Mama, that's Brother Quick, Reverend Brother Quick.
Hi, Brother Quick.
Well, I'm glad to meet you, hon.
Yes, I'm glad to meet you, too.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
All right.
So we're going to have a great time. So everybody sit back, relax. And Brother Quick, you're having a well-deserved time off, so you just kick back, relax, and enjoy the story.
I'm going to do that, my brother.
Yes, sir.
The following is a true story of the Ashtabula Bridge disaster, which occurred in December 29, 1876, However, there are details of this accident which may be too sensitive for some listeners, so listener discretion is advised. It was 145 years ago, on a cold winter's night. Snow was blowing. The wind was blowing. When the number 5 train entering Ashtabula, Ohio, rounded the last curve, approached the Ashtabula Bridge, crossing the Ashtabula Gorge, when, with P.P. Bliss, the well-known gospel songwriter, and many others on board, felt the bridge below them collapse, and the train began to fall. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't realize, for many of them, this was their last moments alive. As the train plunged into the Ashtabula Gorge, 76 feet below, the train wrecked, falling into the gorge below. Screams were heard as the injured were hurt. Then the great fire, as the cars began to burn. The question was, why was not the fire put out? Many other questions were asked. Why did the bridge collapse? In this disaster, the most horrible at the time of the Ashtabula Railroad Bridge disaster, known as the Ashtabula Horror, the worst of its disasters at the time. Find out as we research the details here on the Six Eyes Radio Network on December 30, 2021, January 6, 2022, and January 13th, 2022. Join us by calling 424-243-9617, 424-243-9617. Just press the number 1, join the conversation, and find out for yourself what happened on that most horrible disaster known as the Ashtabula Horror or the Ashtabula Train Disaster. Amen.
Narrative of the greatest railroad disaster on record is a task which has been undertaken. No event has awakened more widespread interest for many years, and the calamity will not cease to have its effect for a long time to come. It was undertaken, the record of them on this account. A familiarity with the locality, the place, and the citizens, personal observation on the spot during the night of the disaster, and a critical exam of the wreck before it was removed in the morning gave people exact knowledge of the accident which few possessed. This followed by intercourse with the survivors, with the friends of the deceased, and the representatives of the press, and by correspondence which resulted from assistance in identifying bodies and searching for relics like watches and things that people had on their bodies when they got hurt, all added to the acquaintance with the event and its consequences. The knowledge of existence from the thorough investigation of the coroner's jury, from the faithful presentation of facts by the reporters of the press, especially those of the Inter-Ocean and the Cleveland Leader, were some newspapers, and from the article published and sent by various friends, which contained sermons, sketches, and biographical notices. He has to acknowledge also encouragements received by Captain J.E. Trueworthy of California, his publishers J.S. Goodman and Lewis Lloyd and Company. The discussions before the country in reference to the cause of the accident, the persons that have read this in different places like the Railroad Gazette, the Railway Age, the Springfield Republican, the New York and Chicago dailies, and many other newspapers. Prominent engineers such as C.P. Buckingham, Clemens Churchill, E.C. Davis, L.H. Clark, Colonel C.R. Morton, E.S. Cheeseborough, Edward S. Philbrick, D.V. Wood, F.R. Smith, and many others have passed their opinion upon it. The accident first seemed to involve the question of the use of iron for bridges and whether the European system was not better than the American. And a comment upon this was given by Charles Collins, the chief engineer, when he testified that $25,000 more would have erected a stone bridge. Yet, as the discussions continued, the conclusion seems to have been reached that riveted iron bridges might be safe if properly constructed. And the engineers appointed by the state legislature of Ohio reported that they find nothing in this case to justify our popular apprehension that there may be some inherent defect in iron as a material for bridges. Find no evidence of weakness in this particular bridge that fell into the Gulf in Ishtabula, which could not have been discovered and prevented. The erection of iron bridges with the trusses all below the track are contrasted with so-called through bridges, also has been discussed. In this case, the tendency to buckling, where the track is supported by iron braces rather than suspended from them, was most apparent. For engineer Gottlieb testified there was not a single brace which was not buckled. Danger from derailment and the fearful result which must follow in high bridges like this is sufficient argument for the addition of guards or some other means to prevent trains from going off. These questions, however, are for railroad engineers to settle. Responsibility of the railroad companies to the American public is a point more important. The Iron Age, speaking of this disaster, says, is a disquieting accident. It also says that we know there are plenty of cheap, badly built bridges, which the engineers are watching with anxious fears, and which to all appearance only stand by the grace of God. The Nation of February 15th says, by such disasters and by shipwreck, our lives in these days sacrificed by the score, and yet except through the clumsy machinery of a coroner's jury, hardly anywhere in America is there the slightest provision made for inquiry unto them. Here are wholesome killings. In 4 cases out of 5, someone is responsible for the accidents. There was a carelessness somewhere, or a false economy has been practiced, or a defective discipline maintained, or some appliances of safety dispensed with, or someone has run for luck and taken his chances. It may be said of this case that the coroner's jury were as thorough and faithful in their investigation as the American public could ask, and yet for the class of reporters who conveyed so inadequately the results of that investigation from day to day, no one was any wiser. The conclusion, however, has been reached, and the verdict corresponds with the evidence shown. We have no space to give to the harsh words that have been spoken. These have come not only from the bereaved friends, but from papers of high standing among manufacturers and others. The accident has been bad enough, and the decision of the coroner's jury sufficiently condemning. The action of the state legislature is also made a matter of investigation. The letter of Charles Francis Adams also called attention to a demand for a railroad commission, and the subject has not been left, as the nation intimates that it might, to a coroner's jury, nor even to a legislative committee, but an enactment of Congress has already passed to bring the subject before the Committee on Railroads. Doubtless the results will be increased safety of travel and the holding of railroad corporations to a strict account by the authority of law for all accidents which may be caused by the want of skillful engineering or proper management. The Weston House break may have caused the projectile force of the whole train to have fallen upon the center of the defective bridge, but there was not some way of stopping trains from plunging entirely down into these fearful chasms. Increased appliances for stopping trains, proper precautions in putting out fires, the frequent inspection of bridges, some method of keeping a strict account of the numbers on the train will be required. The object of this is going to be to discuss these points. It will also be seen by the narrative the religious lessons of the occasion are made most prominent. Anybody who would read the account in these newspapers will notice there's access to the survivors and listed all the sensibilities. Correspondence also showed how much need of consolation there was, and people just found the shadow of the great horror. It's called the Asheville Horror, and there's the same comfort from a view of the lovely characters and the Christian hopes which span this dark cloud with a bow of promise, and will consider this mission has been accomplished. Okay, the scene of this direful event is situated on the Lakeshore Railway, midway between the cities of Cleveland and Erie and about 2 miles from Lake Erie. The village itself contains nearly 2,500 inhabitants. At the mouth of the river is another small village, making in all a population of nearly 4,000. Between these points at the village and harbor, many families of the poorer classes have made their homes, the most of them being Swedes, Germans, and Irish. There are a few fine residences in this part of the town, but the homes of the more prominent citizens are at least a mile away. Near the depot, there are several small places of business, two of three saloons, three hotels, American House, the Culver House, and the Edge Motel, kept by Patrick Mulligan. It was one of the worst places for a railroad disaster. Near the depot on 32nd Street, not 600 yards away to the eastward, was a deep and lonely gorge. Across this, the ill-fated bridge was hung. It was just at the point where the trains from the east were likely to slacken speed. Below that bridge, the stream ran darkly. The only access to the gorge was by a long flight of stairs, which was at the time of the calamity covered with a deep bank of snow. No road existed to it, and the spot could be reached by teams, only as a track was broken through gardens and down steep banks and across the valley and across along the stream. A solitary building was in this gorge. It was the engine house. Here was the massive boiler and engine which were used for pumping water from the stream to the heights above, and so the tanks at either side of the station house in the distance. Situated close by the river and almost under the shadow of the bridge itself, this lone house became to the wrecked travelers a refuge for the fire and storm. On the heights above, toward the depot, another engine house was situated, the place where the Lake Erie, a hand fire engine, stood. Two cisterns for the supply of water were located near, one on either side of the railroad track. It's difficult to picture a place more retired and lonely than this gorge, so near the busy station and yet isolated, accessible and seldom visited. Its distance from the village and the nature of the surroundings will account for many things which occurred on that awful night, but strange tale we have to tell. In the midst of the habitations of men, untold sufferings took place and the loss of life in fearful burning. Fire department consisted of three companies, two at the village and one at the depot on 32nd Street. There were only one steamer, and that was a mile from the depot. These companies were under the control of the chief fireman, Mr. Knapp, who is a tinner by trade and a man slow and lymphatic in temperament, and one who, for a long time, had been addicted to the constant use of intoxicating liquors, man every way unfit for so trying an emergency. The reorganization of the fire department had begun. Many intelligent and prominent citizens were members of it, but these had not been successful in securing the removal of the chief, as several years of association had made many of the firemen satisfied with his services. It's unfortunate that the control was at the time in such incompetent hands, but no one could have anticipated such an event, and no emergency had heretofore shown the necessary for change. The Asheville River is a shallow stream which runs through the county and the town. It has approached the lake. It widens and deepens into what constitutes the harbor. The banks lining the valley of it are high and rocky precipices. They form in a rear or to the southward of the town a gorge, which is called by the inhabitants by the significant name the Gulf. Near the depot, this gorge widens and its banks become less precipitous. But even at this point, the river flows at least 76 feet below the level of the road and is 4 feet deep. Here the fatal but far-famed bridge was built. A grade on an arch viaduct conveyed the track to the abutments, but these stood by themselves straight from the bottom of the gorge, two lofty pillars of stone, 76 feet high, and just wide enough for the two tracks of the road. Flanking these were the lower and smaller abutments of an older bridge, left standing but for a long time unused. The span of the bridge across this gorge from abutment to abutment was the unusual length of 165 feet. The bridge was very high and loomed up in the distance, tall and dark and gloomy. Travelers by the wagon road at a distance up the river a mile away would stop and look at the structure, apparently built high in the air, and watch the cars as they passed in bold relief against the sky, almost as if a specter train were traversing the blue vault above. It was a dizzy height. There was something almost fearful in the sight. The recklessness of danger impressed the observer as the full outline marked itself against the sky. Fascination at times almost reached a sense of the sublime. Here then was the bridge suspended high in air, lofty and tall and dark, a mysterious thing. It was not an arch lifting high its springing sides. It was not a set of beams supported by abutments. Below it was a web of iron netted and braced and bolted, heavy, dark and gloomy in appearance and proving treacherous as death. This bridge was erected in the year 1865 by Mr. Tomlinson, according to orders and patterns given by Mr. Amasa Stone, then president of the road. It was built after the pattern of the Howe Truss, but containing some elements introduced by the president himself. It was constructed of wrought iron, but with long iron braces from lower cord to upper cord 20 feet in height. There were rods stretching from top to bottom and designed to carry the strain from brace to brace. The panels were 11 feet long, and between these, the strength of the cords depended on three iron beams, 6 inches thick and 8 inches wide. The whole width of the bridge was 19 and one-half feet, its height 20 feet, its length 165 feet in a single span. When it was first erected, it was discovered that the braces were placed wrong, so that they came upon the sides rather than upon the edges. The structure settled as the edges were removed about 6 inches and necessitated the change of the process. This error was remedied by a cutting away of iron so the braces could be turned, and this change occupied nearly a year. It was watched with interest by the citizens and was regarded by the builders themselves as a doubtful experiment. In its erection, Mr. Tomlinson, the engineer, differed with the president so much that he resigned his position, and even Mr. Charles Collins never acknowledged that it was a work of his inventing or a bridge receiving his approval. Before the committee appointed by the legislature of Ohio, he acknowledged that it was an experiment, and even when it was in process of erection, he gave no orders, but rather left the responsibility with the president. The deficiency of the bridge, as acknowledged by Mr. Tomlinson, who made the drafts, were that the braces were smaller than was intended and the weight was very great. Its dead weight was 3,000 pounds to the square foot, making an aggregate mass of iron of many tons. The rods or braces had buckled or bent at the first trial, and there was danger that it would fall by its own weight into the creek. As it was changed, however, and the braces sprang back by the elasticity of the iron, heavier braces were put into it, and this shape it stood for 11 years in constant service. The night was portentous. All nature conspired to make it prophetic of some direful event. The sympathy of the natural with the historic event was known and felt. Ominous of evil, a furious storm had set in. Was one of the periodical snowstorms for which the season had been remarkable. Every Saturday throughout the month it had returned, same fearful blasts and fall of snow. As if in mourning, it had come three or four times during the season and now with redoubled force appeared. The snow had fallen all day long and was at the dusk of night still falling with blinding fury. The powers of nature had seized it again and were hurling it down as if in some vengeance against the abodes of men. Everything was covered with the weight of snow. The wreaths and fancy drapery, which during the first storm had engaged the attention of children and pleased the fancy with their forms of beauty and delicate tracery, had now increased until they were heavy blankets and burdensome loads. The feathery flakes, which at first were beds of down, had become solid banks. Everything was buried in the increasing drifts, Even trees and houses and fences stood with muffled forms and bordered with a snowy mantle. The streets were covered with drifts, which were piled high and wide. No attempts had been made to break the roads. The citizens had, for the third time, confined themselves to their homes and had not even opened the path from the doors to the gates. It was, in fact, one of those blinding, burying storms which occasionally come upon northern homes. The greatest comfort was in being at home and having the consciousness of the home feeling. Even the cares of the world were shut out, and many had remained indoors, refusing to be called from the love circle and comfortable fire. Those who were well housed felt a pleasure in their own security and often looked out grateful for the shelter of their homes. But to the traveler, it was a fearful storm. The same clouds which filled the sky with their fleecy masses became portentous to his gaze. As the dust of night settled down with mere fury in the storm, a fearful foreboding filled his heart. There were many who were impressed with this indefinable sense of a danger. It was not because they felt the discomfort of the journey, nor because they unconsciously acknowledged the difficulty of the way, but a strange presentiment continually haunted them, filled them with indefinable fear. Brave hearts sank within many as a strange feeling came over them that there was danger in the air. Pall to the soul, it rested heavily upon the spirits. Stout men had to reason with themselves to nerve themselves to undertake the journey. This presentiment of evil was the common one. Many of the friends urged the travelers to stay and not undertake the fearful journey. Parents at Buffalo were known to have persuaded a daughter to stay until the storm was over and only yielded because a light heart was so buoyant and hopeful in the prospect of a holiday approaching. A wife at Rochester urged a loved husband to stay and was only comforted by the promise of a speedy return. Young husband at Erie, away from his loved wife, was sadly impressed and discussed the question a long time with parents and friends, only went because absence might disappoint the expected companion and because affection for a little babe was stronger than the fear which haunted him. Even the sweet singer of Israel was strangely impressed and had so far yielded to his presentiments as to persuade the ticket agent at the station where he was waiting to exchange tickets and to give him passage by another route, and only the sudden appearance of the train induced him to take it instead of another. Among the other many others, the same forebodings were felt but unexpressed. As the sun went down, the air grew colder. A blast from the north arose, and the snow ceased falling, but the roads and paths were still unbroken. Whoever undertook to breast the storm or to pass through the streets plunged deeply into the untrodden snow. Horses were kept from their accustomed duties and were comfortably stabled for the storm. Nothing was stirring, apparently only the strong iron horse and the solitary train, which slowly made its way along the snow-covered track. Everything was behind time. The train, which was due at Erie at a little after noon, was 2.5 hours late. It should have reached Ashtabula before sundown. It was now dark and the lamps had been burning, but the engine pushed forward. Same train, which had started from New York the night before, had divided at Albany. A portion of it was plunging through the snowdrifts of the mountains of Vermont, and now another portion was struggling amid the snow to the banks of Lake Erie. Both were destined to be wrecked. Four engines had been used to push the train from the station at Erie. Two strong locomotives were straining every nerve to push forward and overcome the deep snow. Within the cars, there were many already anxious about the time. It was a long and well-filled train, but it was greatly behind time. Those from a distance had been delayed throughout all their journey. Those with nearer cities were impatient to meet their friends. To some, a long trip across the continent became an immense and gloomy undertaking. Both the passengers were making the most of the comforts of the hour. The little world by itself, men, women, and children, were mingled together in the precious load. Clergymen, physicians, professional men, businessmen, and travelers, young men and women, those with all classes and places were there. In the distant east and even the distant west, from north and south, their homes were scattered. The continent was represented by that train. It bore the hearts of many, many friends. It was a varied company. Each one was pursuing that which best suited the various tastes and were beguiling the weary hours. An unusual number of parties had gathered to drive away care and weariness by card playing. At least five such parties had cards in their hands at the hour of the sudden calamity. Others have been beguiling the time by tales of adventure and by relating escapes from various dangers. In the smoking car, a group was discussing the weight of the engines and the amount of water used by each engine. Ladies in the sleeping coach were preparing to retire. Some had already laid down in their berth. Gentlemen were quietly dozing in their seats. Others were taking their last smoke before settling themselves for the night. Even the sweet singer had just laid aside the sacred word and was quietly meditating with a song echoing in his heart. It was just a time when everyone was seeking to make himself comfortable for the night, notwithstanding the storm which raged. Few thought of danger as they looked out into the darkness of the night, but the sense of security pervaded the train when suddenly the sound of the wheels was stopped. The bell rope snapped. The lights were extinguished, and in an instant all felt themselves falling. An awful silence seized the passengers. Each one sat breathless, bracing and seizing the seats behind or before them. Not a word was spoken. Not a sound was heard. Nothing except the fearful crash. The silence of the grave had come upon them. It was the fearful pause before an awful plunge. It was the palsied feeling of those who were falling into a fathomless abyss. The sensation was indescribable, awful, beyond description. It seemed an age before they reached the bottom. None could imagine what had happened or what was next to come. All felt as if it was something most dreadful. It was like a leap into the jaws of death, and no one could tell who had escaped from the fearful doom. The cars lay at the bottom of the gorge. That which had been such a thing of speed and a line of beauty now lay wrecked and broken and ready to be burned. It was indeed a beautiful train and was well known for its elegance and beauty. At this time, it consisted of two locomotives, one named Socrates and the other Columbia, two express cars, two baggage cars, two-day passenger coaches, a smoking car, a drawing room car called Yokohama, the New York sleeper named Palatine, and Boston sleeper named City of Buffalo, the Louisville sleeper called Osco. The bridge broke in the center. The engineer of the Socrates suddenly heard a sharp crack, like the report of a torpedo, and looked out and saw the engine behind sinking. With great presence of mind, he opened the throttle valve an instant and, putting on all steam, drove his engine forward. It was like going uphill, but the Socrates reached the abutment and was safe. The Columbia, as it was drawn forward, struck the abutment and for an instant clung to its leader, held by the coupling rod, but as that broke, it fell. First express car struck forward and downward, and landed at the foot of the abutment, while the locomotive fell onto it, completely reversed, with its headlights towards the train, which had been drawing. The other express and two baggage cars also fell to the side of the bridge, forming a line across the chasm with the rear baggage against the east abutment. The heavy iron bridge fell in the same instant with an awful crash to the north, and lay a great wall of iron rods and braces 10 feet high across the gorge. Singularly enough, the track and top of the bridge remained long enough in situ for the bridge to sink and sway away beneath, and then fell straight down and lay at the bottom of the stream immediately below where it rested before, but 76 feet down in the midst of the ice and the snow and water of the stream. Upon this, the first passenger coach landed in an upright position in the middle of the stream and to the left, but close by the wreck of the bridge. The second passenger coach followed, but struck around at an angle and turning on to its side, fell among the rods and braces and was crushed and broken in the fall. The smoker broke its couplings at both ends, struck across and through the second passenger car, smashing it in its course, and then fell upon the top of the first, crushing it down and killing many as it fell. Palace cars followed, but as they fell, they leaped clear of the abutment and flew out into the air to the left of the bridge with their trucks, curled beneath them and dropped 76 feet down and 80 feet out and landed in the center of the chasm. The first drawing room car, Yokohama, landed on the ice and the sleeper Palatine beside it to the right. The sleeper City of Buffalo, however, as it flew through the air, struck across the two, knocking the Yokohama on its side and crushing it in through its hull length, and landed on its forward end with its rear end resting on the other two and high in the air. As the different cars fell, every person for the instant was stunned, and the crashing of one car on another struck many dead in an instant, while the survivors waited in suspense, expecting death would come also to them at the next blow. The work of death was owing mostly to the fall and to the crashing of cars and heavy trucks on bodies and limbs and even the very hearts of many. It's probably instantaneous to the large majority of those who perished, but a few were taken out of the wreck with any evidence of having perished from the flames, which soon broke out. The wonder was that any escaped to tell the manner of their escape. As the car struck, splinters flew in every direction. The floor burst up from below. The seats were crushed in front and behind. The roofs were crushed from above. The sides opened and yawned, and as one expressed it, it seemed as if every limb and sense were being scattered, and only the soul was left in its solitariness. More than one imagined that he was the only survival, that all the rest had perished in an instant. Many thought their time had come. The thought of fire also arose in many minds, and the fear of a death that might be more dreadful than that by the crash. Without the wreck was strewn along the iron beams and columns of the broken bridge and scattered in terrible confusion. Ice and water and snow were mingled with rods of iron and heavy braces and beams, and the debris of cars and the bodies of men. Danger threatened from all the elements. If they remained in the wreck, the fire threatened them with a horrid death. If they fled the fire, the water threatened to engulf them. If they escaped the water, the darkness and chill of night, the storm and the awful stunning, bewildered and appalled. The very sight of the lofty abutments towering high impressed them with fear. The wild and lonely gorge strewn with snow and swept by the furious storm conveyed a sense of wildness and strangeness in the extreme. It was a bewildering and an appalling scene. As one after another, the stunned and stupefied survivors began to emerge from the broken wreck. They were dazed by the wildness of the place. The experience of everyone was different. Some dragged themselves from the debris and escaped through the broken windows, tearing clothes and flesh as they emerged. Others climbed through openings in the side or top and so made their way into the open air and the gloomy night. Others broke the glass doors with their fists and dragged themselves through the openings thus made and sought to draw out others. Some became insensible and were only removed by force and taken by their friends to a place of safety. Strong men were bruised and stunned and were led by their wives. Others found themselves bleeding before they knew they were hurt and even hobbled with broken limbs, not knowing what was their wound. Some sank into the water and were with difficulty rescued by their companions and dragged out upon the ice and snow. Many, as they got out, found themselves amid the rods and braces and hardly knew which way to turn. Some emerged from the doors and fell into the snow and water. A lady climbed out a window and walked on the sides of the car that lay wrecked beneath and climbed down the back of a man who was willing to become a ladder for her escape. Another escaped with broken limbs, which by force she had dragged from beneath the wreck and then by the rods and braces drew herself to shore through the water into which she had fallen. Another still was able to get out of the car where lay her child and nurse and was dragged in her nightclothes through the water and snow and across the ice and then stood upon the bank in the storm-like specter exclaiming, There is my child. I hear its voice. A father rescued his little children, mere babies as they were, and placed them on the snow for strangers to take and then returned for his wife. She was held by the wreck and it badly hurt and exclaims that she cannot be saved but begs her husband to cut her throat, lest the fire should reach her and she be burned to death. She is, however, rescued, and the whole family is safe. A gentleman gets out but finds that his limbs will not obey his will, but sink beneath its weight, and he's obligated to crawl on hands and knees to a place of safety. After all others have escaped, something attracts the attention of those on the bank as if a coat were flapping in the wind. Next, the man appears as if attempting to arise, and then the man emerges from the region of the flames and is helped to the shore by others. Many became so exhausted and faint that they felt senseless upon the snow and were drawn by others to a place of safety. Even thought that some were so bewildered that they wandered into the broken places in the ice and were drowned. It was but a few minutes before all who could had escaped, and the rest were still struggling to get out or were already dead. The citizens were startled by a sudden crash. Those who lived near the bridge knew that the train was late. Many of them were in some way connected with the road, either as telegraph or baggage men, or in some capacity of the railroad service. For some reason, there was an expectancy among them all. Those who dwelt on the banks of the gorge could look from their rear windows and see each train as it came. As the first awful crash was heard, the whole neighborhood was startled. Then, as the ominous sound of car following car fell upon the ear, crash after crash in quick succession, the horrible consciousness came to all who had appalling force. Some started to their feet with alarm. Others rushed to the doors and hastened to the scene. One lady, Mrs. Absorpe, exclaimed to her husband in terror and great alarm, "My God, Henry, number 5 has gone off the bridge." As her husband seized his hat and coat and hastened out of the door, with a woman's sympathy, she put the kaffir bottle into his hands, thinking of the wounded and the suffering which must follow. But a few minutes had passed before a number were at the depot. The engineer of the pup engine was standing on the depot platform as the train approached. As he heard the sound, he looked up and could see the cars from the middle of the train plunge off to the side of the bridge and fall into the abyss. The headlight of the engine was above the track, but the passenger cars were falling behind it. Painter was also in the shop and heard the crash. The saloon keeper of one of the hotels and the foreman of the fire engine, Lake Erie, also heard and saw the fall. These were the first to start for the wreck and reach it very soon. Mr. Amthorpe also was early on the ground. These, as they approached, were appalled at the awful scene. The engineer seized an axe and pail as the first things which were at hand, and hardly knowing what he was doing, attempted to break the doors and windows for the wounded to escape. Mr. Tinley plunged into the water and swam to the other side to rescue those who were at the distance in the wreck. The omnibus man began to chop to get an opening for those within, but cut an awful gash into his foot and was obliged to cease. Mr. Amthorpe, more deliberate and self-controlled, first thought of the bell and of giving the alarm, but hastened to the train. He went from car to car, entering such as were open and could be reached, and sought to help out those who might be left inside. Others arrived and helped the wounded to escape from the water and ice and up the bank. All were excited and hardly knew what they were doing and did not think of what next to do. The engineer fluttered to and fro, excited and uncontrolled. The saloon keeper assisted a few and then disappeared. Some who arrived stood on the bank amazed and appalled, but idle and passive amid the scene. In the meantime, the flames began to arise. It was only a little glimmering light at first, so small that as the passengers pass, they throw snow and a portion of it is quenched. A few buckets of water thrown at this time would have sufficed to have kept down the flame, but the critical moment was past. The fire began at both ends of the wreck and rapidly spread. It was just a little flame on the east side underneath the sleeper. It was brighter in the smoker and in the heap near the bridge, but it spread from car to car and soon enveloped the whole. No one thought that the fire could be prevented. The desire to rescue the wounded and save the living was more urgent. It was too constraining for any deliberate thought. It crowded out every effort to prevent the spreading of the flames. Everyone was appalled and overwhelmed and did that which seemed most pressing at the moment. The brakeman Stone, who had escaped unhurt, thought only of another train, which was expected soon. He hastened to the telegraph office to tell of the wreck and to stop the coming train. The conductor was almost paralyzed with terror and became frantic with excitement and rushed to and fro, calling for help, and instead was kept with difficulty from throwing himself into the fire. The flames kept arising. They spread far and wide. They ascended high and still higher. They filled the valley. A cloud of smoke ascended, too. It was black and dense and pitchy. Came from the paint and varnish and the materials of the gilded wreck, stifling to the breath and deadly to all who breathed it. It enveloped the ruins. It even darkened the sky and rolled a thick cloud through the awful gorge. The worst of fears began now to be realized. Horror seized the living, for death now claimed its victims, and man was powerless to deliver. Within the awful canopy of the flames shot up, and from among them came forth groans and shrieks and cries of agony and despair. Then followed the most heart-rending scenes and incidents. Those who were without, but who had friends still left in the burning cars, shouted loud and begged that the fire might be put out. They even sought to go back to get their friends. Yells arose from the valley and were echoed in shouts from the top of the abutments, and one wild scene of excitement pervaded the spot. A little child was heard to exclaim, "Papa! Oh, Papa, take me!" A woman cried from within a car, "Oh, save me, for God's sake, take my child." A man had clasped a woman to carry her from the flames, but her foot was caught, and he was obliged to leave her and save himself. Another saw underneath the floor of a car a man and woman lying there and calling for help. He tried to extricate them, but as the flames arose, he went to the firemen and begged them to put on water and save the living. Mr. Emthorpe saw a woman trying to get out of the window of a car high up amid the ruins. She was halfway out and called for help. He hastened to the rescue, but the flames arose between him and her, and she perished there. Two men were seen sitting on their seats, surrounded by the flames, but they perished, and no one could save them. One man stood by his berth and burned to death, holding to his side a gentleman supposed by some to be Mr. Brunner of Wisconsin, and by others to be Mr. P.P. Bliss, sweet singer, was seen to emerge and then go back, saying that he will perish with his family. A gentleman was seen in the midst of the flames, standing as if surrounded by a wall of fire, until he fell. Appalling sounds and sights struck shock every heart and send a shiver of horror through every frame. The howl of a poor wounded dog echoes through the valley. A woman whose children have already perished is seen lifting up her hands and beseeching help, and was at last rescued among the last, awfully burned, and died in a few days from her wounds. The last one removed was the fireman and then his poor dog, which had kept up its piteous howling. The living were driven from the wreck and could only stand and look upon the awful scene. A city arose, a horrid cry. It was not a shriek. It was not a groan, not even a cry for help, but it was a plaintive, melancholy wail, the desperate cry of those who knew they must die. It's prolonged and agonized, a heart-rending moan. It was the sound of, "Oh, oh, 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 oh." Then all were dead, and silence settled down upon the scene, the awful silence which comes from upon the dead. The parched lips were sealed forever. The stifled breath could no longer send forth a cry or groan. The carnival of death had at last silenced all its victims. The slaughter was complete, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. Flames leaped and danced and lifted high their heads, and death was an exultant in all its forces. The canopy of blackness arched the snow-covered valley, while the fiery billows rolled between. All that man could do was to stand and look upon the scene, appalled. The citizens of the village were sitting by their fires or at their tables or in their places of business. A sound was heard. It was a sudden, startling sound. To those who were living near the depot, it was a succession of sounds. First a crash, then a fall, then a distinct sound for every car. To those who were at the distance, it was a single, but a prolonged and terrible crash. to those who were within doors, it seemed like a sudden fall of a distant building or the nearest slide of a heavy body of snow, but much more ominous. Some imagined they heard a sound that followed, which they supposed to be the wailing of the wind. It startled the inhabitants in many houses and was heard more than a mile away. Presently, the sharp alarm of fire was heard, and the bells rang out their pealing notes. Many started from their seats at the thought of fire on such a night. Presently, the sky was illuminated. A strange glare filled the heavens. It was not like a distant flame that cast its shadow on the sky. It was not like a nearer fire that shot up sparks and smoke. It was a glare that pervaded the whole horizon. It cast a pale and sickly color into the fleecy air. It covered even the snow with a pinkish, almost crimson hue. It seemed like an extensive burning, as if the flames were suddenly arising from widespread structures. No one could tell, however, what it was nor what was the matter. The men who rushed into the street first whispered it was an oil train that had caught fire on the track. Others said that it was the building at the depot. Women who were kept at home were impressed that it was something more than a common fire. Uneasiness seized the aged who were residing in houses far distant. Many hastened for the engines. Others ran in the direction of the light. All plunged into the deep snow and out of breath could only follow a single file along the path which the foremost had broken. A long line of men and boys reached from the main street toward the fatal spot. Horses and teams plunged madly by. Every available horse in one of the stables was put into use. The steamer was got out. The horses attached pulled and tugged the massive load. Protection engine was also manned at first, but afterward drawn by a team secured. Hose carts were taken for a distance, and then horses were attached to these. Villagers had become thoroughly aroused and were straining every nerve to reach the fire. It had become known that the bridge was broken, and a passenger train was wrecked in the dreadful gorge. An unregulated crowd was rushing from all haste through the impending drifts. The thought was all but to hasten forward and save the living. It seemed an age before they could reach the spot. Many became exhausted by their efforts. The snow and drifts were so deep that none could make headway, except with difficulty. Even teams were detained by the snow. It was at least 20 minutes before the citizens arrived. Time enough had been passed for the work of death. The wounded passengers had recovered from the stunning fall and arisen to their feet and escaped to the shore, assisting one another from the wreck. Nearly all who were in the forward car had escaped, except those who had been crushed by the trucks, which had broken through the roof and fell upon them. One had, even after his escape, looked in the window and put his face near the cheek of his companion and found him dead. Those in the smoker had come out and looked back to see how complete the sweep of the burning stove had been, which had carried several before it to their death. One had fallen out of a gaping seam made in the side of that car, looked back to see another man caught as the car closed again, and thought to himself that it opened on purpose to let him out. Those in the sleeping coaches who were alive had also escaped and made their way to land. One gentleman, Mr. Brewster, who was but little hurt, had assisted a man who was badly wounded and helpless amid the wreck and laid him down at the east embankment and then crossed the stream again and called out to others, saying, "This way, here's a house." Women had escaped from the rear sleeping coach and were already at the shore. Miss Shepherd, who was unhurt, had reached the bank and requested someone to help her up, and then made herself useful in aiding others. Those who had escaped on the north side were already making their way through the deep drifts and the lonely valley and up the steep embankment. Those who were near had done all they could to rescue the living, and the flames were already arising and nearly covered the scene. All this had occurred before the citizens from the town could reach the spot. It was then too late to do anything to save the wounded or even to keep the flames from destroying life. To be sure, the fire engine stood in that engine house upon the hill, but it was never moved. The pump engine also stood in the lonely valley with its steam up, but it was not used. There was also a hose in the upper engine house, not 600 yards away, which would fit a plug in the house by the river. But in the confusion of the moment, no one had thought of engines or a hose, or even buckets had been brought down. Meanwhile, the teams from town were plunging on, dragging the steamer and the hose through the heavy drifts. The station agent, who had received a telegram from the central office to get surgeons and aid for the wounded, was also hastening to the spot, but it was too late. The work was done. It was impossible for them to rescue the living. Those who had reached the scene had already rescued nearly all the wounded and the living, though fearfully bruised and some of them insensible from the fire. Others were standing and looking on from the banks, idle spectators of the scene, and before the eyes of all, the fire had crept on and was now enveloping the hole. The wounded lay in the snow or on the damp, cold floor. The water dripped from their garments and ran upon the stone. Blood flowed from wounds and mingled with the water. Chill and damp and pain in wounds and the shock and fright were combined. Gashed and bruised and broken, they were crawling up that lonely, chilly bank. But the flames without were burning and eclipsing all their misery. Falling death was shooting from car to car, and the dreadful valley had become an awful scene. It was too terrible for any human mind. The groans of the wounded were mingled with the groans of the dying, and shouts and groans and shrieks and cries echoed through the valley. Then the plaintive wail and the awful silence. The firemen arrived at last. The station agent had reached the spot before them. All was haste and confusion, no orders and no one in command. The wounded were already coming up the bank. Citizens, as they came, had taken their survivors from the wreck and were now helping them to a place of safety and comfort. Appalled by the scene and confused by the horror, none knew what order was to be given or who was in command. Mr. Absorpe was in the employ of the road and was supposed to have some control. As Mr. Strong hastened to the rescue, he asked, "What shall we do?" The reply was, "Get men to help up the wounded." As the chief fireman met Mr. Strong, he asked, "Where shall we put the hose? Where shall we apply the water?" The echo of Mr. Absorpe's remark was the only response. "We want to get out the wounded, never mind the water." Second time the question was asked as the station agent appeared in another place, and a second time the response was, "We don't want water when they get out the wounded. Get all the men to clear a road to the wreck." Again, as the fireman undertook to lay the hose, another official of the road used a vulgar illustration, saying there was no use in throwing water on the flames. The impression was thus given by those in command of the wreck and the road that water was not wanted. The chief fireman was not a man to assume the responsibility under such circumstances. He was dazed and confused and not seemed to know what to do. The horses stood hitched to the steamer. The hand engine protection also stood, the men waiting for orders. Someone ran up from the wreck begging, for God's sake, that water should be thrown, but both engines stood waiting. The call for buckets went up from below. One old man, 76 years old, was in the midst of the wreck, chopping for dear life and calling for buckets at the same time. His son, arriving late, plunged into the midst of the fire and began to work like one made desperate with despair. Others took pails and undertook to go out to rescue bodies that were burning. Driver of the steamer took the engine to the cistern and stationed it there, but no orders were given, and the hose carts were ready to be unreeled, but no orders were given. The whistle of the steamer was sounded for hose, and the men stood ready to lay it. Many wondered at the delay and talked excitedly, but still no orders. Captain of the steamer asked the station agent if he should reply water, but the same answer was returned. The chief fireman still remained stupid and passive and gave no orders. At last he went himself to the wreck and began to help remove the wounded while the men still waited and the engines were idle. The men became impatient, but they were held by authority of the chief. Fire was still burning, but that answer of the station agent held the chief fireman and yielded to the direction and abandonment of the engines and his men. A man who had seen two persons still living underneath the wreck comes up and begs that water be thrown, but the engines stand idle and the firemen dare not work without orders. The more determined of them leave the engines and go down to the wreck to work without them. Pails are procured from the stores, and with them the firemen work. Each day, great exertions are made to extinguish the flames in this way. Desperation has taken possession of the citizens. An hour has passed, and it is stated that there are some still living, but the engines stand idle. There is talk even of disobeying orders and assuming command, but the law is quoted, and that is prevented. Men fly here and there, anxious to save the living. Others assist the wounded. Some stand on the banks with hands in their pockets and took on unmoved, but the fire still burns. A few seize a rope and fasten it to the locomotive and try to lift it off from one poor wretch who lies beneath it, but the time passes and the flames are not subdued. A line is begun for the purpose of passing water and so putting fire out, but a voice was heard from the top of the abutment saying, "You don't want water there. Don't put any water on the wreck." A few rushed for the hand engine, thinking to take it down the steep bank to the creek. Arrangements are made and a hose is attached, but the decision of the fireman or foreman is not to take it down. Still, a few persevere with their buckets. The flames in one place are put out by this means, but no effort is made by the engines, and the men stand waiting. Horses become restive. Captain of the steamer remains at his post. The firemen await his command, but the order is never sent. Lives cannot now be saved, and the bodies are burning. A woman is seen in the midst of the wreck. Life is extinct, but the body is held by the iron framework high in the air. Her clothes caught fire, and she begins to burn like a martyr at the stake. The spectators are horror-stricken by the sight. Few form a line, and with buckets throw water in that direction until the body falls and lies buried with others. The fire at the engine is next attacked after the fireman is rescued. Poor dog, which has kept up his piteous howl, was also taken from the same place. This is the last living creature taken out, but the bodies still burn. The wind blows cold, but the fire burns on. The strangest and misunderstanding has taken possession of all. Whatsoever the motive of those in authority, the effect was to keep the engines from playing upon the flames. There were tanks on both sides of the track. The engines were both on the ground. There was hose sufficient, but the misunderstanding made everything useless, and the department was held back and did nothing. The indignation of the citizens was openly expressed, but the fire continued. Mr. Stebbins, a citizen, asked the captain of the steamer why water was not thrown, and was answered, "The chief would not order it." He explained, "We had better hang him then," but the fire continued to burn until in places it burned itself out, and there was nothing more to feed upon. Nothing was left except the bodies, and those were almost consumed. The fumes of the burning flesh filled the air, and the horrid consciousness haunted the hearts of the spectators, but the fire burned on, and the strange suspense held the people. An engine house stood on the bank. It was the place where water was pumped from the river to the bank of the tank at the depot building. It was a little brick building with a stone floor and a large boiler and engine occupying the middle of the room. Into this building, the wounded were taken and were laid on the cold, damp floor, a ghastly throng. As citizens came, they found them there, suffering from the cold as well as from the shock and wounds. The effort was made to take them to places of more comfort, but where to take them was the question. No one was there at the time to command. A few men were there to assist. Some were there to plunder, and more had come not knowing for what they came. A long, weary flight of steps had led from the gorge to the track above. Up this flight, the wounded were taken. On the other side, the access to the wreck was only through the deep snow and down the steep bank. Line of men was formed at last. Up both sides of the track, the wounded are helped, passed from hand to hand, where they are able to stand. Others were borne by the citizens and by degrees, with pains and groans, and amid the wild excitement, the most of them were removed. The nearest house to the scene was a place called the Eagle Hotel, kept by Patrick Mulligan. Into this, by some chance, 11 of the wounded were carried. It's a horrid place, a dirty bar room. Rooms which had never known a carpet, but whose floors were soon covered with snow and water, little bedrooms just large enough to hold a bed and washstand, without carpets or stove, beds that consisted of filthy sheets and miserable straw ticks. It was a house forbidding in every respect. Into this place the wounded were taken, bleeding and gashed, and laid two by two on the miserable pallets. There they lay in the clothes which they had on, covered with blood, cold, and cheerless, while crowds of curious spectators trooped in and out through the weary hours of the long and dreadful night. Others, fortunately, were taken to better quarters, but even some of these were robbed on the way of the money which they had in their pockets by the very persons who pretended to assist them in their helpless state. Teams were secured, a road was broken, into the gorge sleds were difficulty taken down, and into these the badly wounded are placed. The two little children who had escaped are also taken in these, badly burned and insensible, and placed with their father in a private house. The mother is moved and laid in another house and lies in great agony. A young girl, timid and frightened, whose limbs are broken, is separated from her aunt and placed among strangers. Amid great confusion, those who are able walk to the hotel, some of them pursued by those who would rob them. A father calls out from a stretcher, a daughter whose strangers are taking in another direction, and becomes almost frantic with excitement till the girl is brought back to him. The poor burned woman, whose children are dead, is borne to the Culver House. The bruised, gashed, and bleeding passengers are at last removed from the valley. They are distributed throughout the neighborhood, upon couches and beds of the few hotels, upon the counters of stores, on the floors of private houses, and even in the saloons. They are scattered until the whole vicinity becomes a hospital. Surgeons are all at work. The wounds are hastily dressed. The blood is washed away. Many are wrapped in warm coverings. Comparative quiet and rest settle down. The spectators have left the smoking ruins, and in curious crowds have trooped through the houses and have gradually disappeared. Those on the abutment return to their homes. The firemen themselves disperse. Last one in the engine house has gone. Only a very few are left to guard the dead. A wild and lonely season remains. The dead are left there alone. The snow drifts toward the smoking ruins. Nature weaves a white shroud. Night draws down a black pall. The silence of the grave settles upon the lonely spot. A flickering light from the funeral pyre sends up a glare through the darkness, and the dead stare from the blackened bars with eyeless sockets, and the bodies are left to burn. It's a horrible, heart-sickening sight. The bodies still smolder in the burning grave, and the smell of their flesh arises on the darkening air. The fire continued to burn. For a time, the wreck was left unguarded. When it was that so much plundering occurred, no one knows. The flames were lifting up their lurid light and covering the ghastly scene with a sickening glare. The dead lay in every direction amid the arriving snow. A skull lay by itself amid a blackened heap whitened by the fire. The heap of bodies lying in the sleeping coaches were still burning. And yet, this appalling scene did not intimidate the human vultures who were looking for their prey. The ravening wolf that prowls at night would be driven from such a horrid place by very fear. The hearts of men were on that fearful night more greedy than wolves or vultures are for mid and that awful wreck they sought for spoil. One and another of the wounded had been robbed. Men were more merciless than their fellows than the cruel flames. One young man who had lost both mother and sister was suffering from four broken ribs and a severe gash in the head. As he looked up and saw the men standing and watching, the thought of robbers crossed his mind. He had a valuable watch, a present from his father, two purses, one containing $50 in bills and the other a few dollars in change, and his mother's jewelry. At the thought of the thieves came up, he turned around with his back to the crowd and dropped his watch down his neck, inside his shirt, and there left it suspended by the chain next to his person. One purse he placed inside his vest and an inside pocket, and the other was left in the pocket of his pantaloons. Someone offered to assist him up the stairs. As he reached the top, this person disappeared, and another came. Taking him by the arm, the robber drew it out in such a way that the broken ribs gave intense pain and caused the poor boy to faint and fall. As he fell, he remembers to have felt a hand reached into his bosom, and then he became unconscious and lay upon the snow. When he came to himself, his purses and his ticket to California were gone, and all he had left was the watch he had hidden and the clothes he wore. Among strangers, with mother and sister both dead, poor young man was at last taken to a hotel and telegraphed the sad news to his father in the distant home. Another gentleman who, as he was being helped to a hotel, was robbed of all he had in his vest pocket on the side towards the one who supported him. Still another was followed by a person who pretended to be a physician and offered to assist, but escaped by threats at such speed as he could command. Much valuable property was removed for the bodies of the dead. One gentleman had upon his person a valuable diamond pin, a commander's badge, a Sir Knight's pin, and other valuable jewelry. When his body was found, nothing was left except a cheap pair of celluloid sleeve buttons. Watches were removed from chains, and the jewelry and trunks were taken or mysteriously disappeared. More than $1,500 worth of valuable articles were afterwards recovered by the mayor, by a proclamation, and by detectives. A saloon keeper was found to have appropriated shawls and satchels, and others were found to have diamonds and jewelry in their possession, which had been stolen. A young man who had a splinter from the cornice of the car driven through his collarbone was robbed of $300 in money at the Eagle Hotel where he lay, and a gentleman from Hartford had his boots taken from his feet and carried away. The dead in the valley and the wounded in the streets and the survivors in other places were alike subject to this villainous pillaging. A pair of dominoes or black masks were found, showing how deliberate had been the robbery with the villains who were out that night. Scarcely anything of value was left after the wreck. One gentleman who had $7,000 on his person was killed and his pocketbook found, but the money was gone. The trunks contained the wardrobes of brides, and the jewelry of the wealthy were burned and destroyed. Watches were burned in the fierce flames until the gold was melted into nuggets and everything that could be treasured by friends, whether it was the clothes of the dead or the priceless or precious keepsakes they had, or the bodies which were more precious than jewels, all disappeared and not a relic or trace could be found. At 12 o'clock, quietness had settled down upon the scene. The streets were deserted. All had formed the impression that bodies were to be burned and had gone to their homes, leaving the wreck still burning and the dead to be consumed. The engines had been ordered to their houses. The lights glimmered from the homes where the wounded were lying. A few were at the wreck. Expressman guarding the treasures in the safe sat solitary and alone through the long hours while the flames, which were burning precious bodies, crackled and threw their lurid light across the scene. The smell of burning flesh pervaded the air even half a mile away. Horrid sight was presented in the awful valley. The flames, which had blazed so high, had consumed the wood and furniture of the train. The gilded palaces were reduced to mere skeletons of iron. The bridge lay a mere network of blackened beams. The trucks and wheels and heavy rods were lying in every direction, but beneath these horrid ribs of death lay the blackened bodies of men, women, and children, burned and still burning amid the snow and ice. Blue tongues of fire shot here and there amid the blackened mass as if some unseen monster were still licking up the life of its unburied victims. The white snow lay like a winding sheet along the valley, but the skeleton was in the midst with the tall abutments towering above and the precious bodies silent in death beneath the ruins. A long line of bodies lay packed on the bridge just above the water of the stream. They were covered with trucks and brakes and heavy bars and the debris of wood and the ashes of the wreck. Packed in a horrid mass, they lay crushed and broken and blackened by the smoke and heat. Ghastly forms lay in this open grave. Headless, armless trunks were placed with the broken limbs and the heads from which the brains were oozing, while the stumps of arms seemed lifted from the blackened heaps as if the mute supplication, too shocking for any human heart. The delicate form of a mother lay beside her little child, but both reduced to mere black lumps with scarcely a semblance to a human form. Full-sized woman lay amid the mass, but with no sign of either legs or arms except the broken bones which had been crushed away by the fall. Bodies of men also lay cut completely asunder, and presenting only the half of the human form, an awful, sickening sight. Everywhere through the valley, there were bodies lying silent in death. The pale flames, which flickered here and there, betokened where many of them lay. Underneath the horrid bars of iron on the black, deceitful ice, in the watery depths of the unconscious stream, packed in heaps underneath the burning cars, were the dead. The appalling and terrifying scene, the darkness and loneliness and the very desertion were enough, but through the very nerves there came the horrid consciousness of the many, many dead. Far away were their friends. The night was lonely and the storm was pitiful, but scattered through that grave were the bodies of the dead. It's hard to realize it, but to the hearts of friends, those unburied were no strangers, and yet they burned in loneliness. The railroad authorities came at 1:30. Five surgeons from the homeopathic college in Cleveland, the superintendent, the assistant superintendent, the train dispatcher, and others. The wounded were in their beds at the time. The fireman was at the Eagle Hotel. The engineer was at Mr. Ampthorpe's. Two other persons also who needed surgical operations were at the same house. The surgeons of the road, as they arrived, sought first the employees, the firemen, and the engineer, and to these gave their professional attention. The surgeons of the village had already attended to the passengers, had dressed the wounds of most of them, were waiting for the proper reaction to perform the amputation on those whose limbs were broken. 10 surgeons were at one time crowded into one small house, where the worst cases were placed by morning. However, the amputation was performed by Dr. J.C. Hubbard, assisted by Drs. Fricker and Case, and about 20 of the wounded, including the fireman and engineer, were moved to the hospital in Cleveland. This relieved many of those who were at the Eagle Hotel, as they found comfortable quarters at the hospital, and the rest were taken into rooms where a fire could be built and where a carpet covered the floor. But through all the night, the fire continued to burn. The haggard dawn drove the darkness out of the valley of the shadow of death. Seldom was revealed a ghastlier sight. On either side of the ravine frowned the dark and bare arches from which the treacherous bridge had fallen, while at their base the great mass of ruins covered the men and women and children who had so suddenly been called to death. The cherished bodies lay where they had fallen or where they had been placed in the hurry and confusion of the night. Piles of iron lay on the thick ice or embedded in the shallow stream. Fire smoldered in great heaps where many of the helpless victims had been consumed, while men went about in wild confusion seeking some trace of their friends among the wounded or dead. The morning dawned. Those who had known of the event awoke as if from a fearful dream. The horror of the great calamity haunted the sleeping hours and came back with returning consciousness. The dream was indeed a sad reality. The bodies which were wrapped in the sleep of death and whose bed was the driven snow were the first thought at the awakening of the living. Nothing else was thought of in the village. Those who had not heard of it were startled by the news, but those who had seen and known were strangely impressed. The smell of the burning flesh seemed to pervade the air. The sight of dead bodies seemed to fill the eye. The flames, the fearful flames, the ghastly wounds, the blackened bodies, and the unknown unburied dead were before the mind. Death had descended like a bird of night and flapped the dark wing over the abodes of the living, casting a shadow over the whole place, and then descended into the valley and was still watching its victims. There was something fearful in such an awful devastation by the dread monster. But with the sense of the nearness of death came another still more fearful to the mind. There was mingled with the thoughts of the dead another of the living, which was even more horrible to the mind. A great shadow hovered over the place. It was not the shadow of the angel which had descended with its dark wings. It was not the unseen messenger of God. It was not of the horror that walked in darkness or the destruction that wasted at noon of night, but a horrible suspicion had seized the people. The horrid selfishness of men haunted the waking thoughts as terrible death had the sleep of night. Cruelty was ascribed to men, worse even than the awful fall and death. The burning of the bodies was ascribed to design. The impression was a general one. Indignation was mingled with horror that retiring to homes while the bodies burned was not the result of indifference. Few were so heartless as to care more for sleep and for the safety of the dead. Many could not sleep that night, but somehow the impression had taken possession of the people that the burning was divine. As the citizens returned to their homes late at night, they had their suspicion and grown sick at heart. The firemen themselves had laid the blame somewhere else than upon their chief. It seemed too inhuman, and yet it was believed the station agent was known and trusted. His character was well established. His humane and kindly heart was not impeached. His Christian life and courtesy were well known to all, but the feeling was universal and the suspicion strong. The control of the company over the cars and all the contents was taken for granted. Responsibility of common carriers was known, and no one could understand why orders should be given to withhold the water, except it was to destroy the traces of those who were on the train. For the time, this was believed. The sentiment was so common that even an employee of the road was heard to say that ashes did not count, but bodies did. There was no foundation for the report. It was all the result of that strange mistake. As was afterwards shown, no such order had been given, and the persons in command were not responsible for the mistake, but for the time it had its effect. That midnight hour showed how strong this conviction had become. The deserted streets, the silent engines, the stabled horses all betokened a thought which ruled the night. A strange misunderstanding had controlled that fatal hour, yet nonetheless powerful because so strange. As men went in the morning, this was the first thought they were expressed with. It was the main subject of remark. Many supposed that the order had been given from the central office, but had no means of correcting or confirming their belief. Others maintained there was a reason for the order, as the throwing of water upon hot iron was likely to create steam. And this, it was said, would destroy more lives than even the flames and would deface the bodies. It was held by some to be the general policy of railroad companies to allow wrecks to be burned, and this was given as the reason that steam would be generated, which would immediately cover the wreck and drive away those who would rescue the living. Gentlemen of intelligence and caution discussed that point with earnest warmth. Little knots of men would gather and express their pent-up feelings. Others supposed that this popular indignation was the result of a terrible pressure and that weighed on the spirits, as if indignation were the safety valve for the oppressed heart. These convictions of the people arose above all other feelings. The better sympathies were awakened and rebuked the very selfishness which was abhorred. The passions which were excited were to the praise of the better feelings of the heart. The kind and generous emotions were protesting against a cruelty which was imagined. It was not supposed at the time that the same humane feelings existed in the hearts of those in command. It was a soulless corporation, it was said, and men did not stop to reason. Horrible thing had occurred, a fatal mistake. The awful negligence and the fearful burning were combined. Somebody was responsible. The citizens felt that it could not be themselves, and yet the corporation remained unconscious of the charge. For several days, the popular feeling continued. It was even reflected back in the reports of the press. As the friends arrived, they partook of the feeling and swelled its force. The sentiment came back from distant places, and the little village was intensely moved. It was because of the heart of a great nation was moved, and the shock which appalled and paralyzed the whole land sent back its chilling horror to the very center. Far and wide over the long wires, the startling message had made its way. Families on the distant hill tops of the New England states, men in the green valleys of the California shores, at the distant south and in the snowy north, in the great city and the little hamlet, the fact was known. Everywhere, the shock was felt. Every eye was fixed upon the startling headlines. Every heart was moved as the news was read. All other things were forgotten in the great horror. The greatest railroad disaster on record had taken place. The Brooklyn horror was eclipsed by a greater. Angola was surpassed. Norwalk and the many other catastrophes were all forgotten. Ashtabula was known. and became the synonym for the event. But mingled with the startling news was the silent question which the citizens were discussing on that gloomy morning. Why was not the fire put out? Nor did the feeling cease or the surprise and sad suspicion die away for many a day. As the tidings reached the neighboring countries or counties, vast numbers began at once to flock in. Trains arrived by other roads. Each train came laden with passengers. The streets were filled with people. All were excited, sooner even than the friends of the lost, these crowds reached the wreck. The friends at a distance were, however, detained as it was, not the purpose to allow them to come to witness the horrid scene until a suitable disposal of the dead was made. The police stationed on the ground endeavored to keep back the curious crowds, but in many cases found it impossible. It was not known whether the control was in the hands of the railroad company or the village authorities. They were mostly railroad men who were superintending the work. The excitement of the citizens was not diminished, as it seemed so doubtful who were in control. The fact that the mayor of the city was in the employ of the road as assistant engineer only increased this feeling. At the time of the accident, there was no coroner in the place. Proper officer had previously declined. Another had to be appointed in this place. Access being denied to the spot and the supposition having obtained that the control was in the hands of the company rather than of the village corporation, the suspicion increased. The very efforts of the authorities to protect the place and keep back the curious strengthened the conviction. Strange feeling pervaded the place and was spread throughout many parts of the country. It was the element which most excited the people and which called attention from the widespread public. The only answer is that the calamity was too appalling for man's reason, and those in command seemed to have lost their judgment in the excitement of the hour and were held by the misunderstanding which so unjustly arose. There was no evidence that this burning was intended. Was that reasonable to suppose it? The report was entirely untrue, the suspicion wrong, but in the excitement of the hour, it was felt and was a strange feature in the event. At 8 o'clock, work was begun upon the wreck. Guards were stationed about the spot. Planks were placed upon the ice. Men were employed to remove the debris of wood and iron. Boxes were procured in which to place the dead. A special policeman was stationed at the head of the stairway. No one was permitted to go on the ice except the workmen who were engaged in removing the debris. The mayor of the city was on the ground. The stationing of the police was at his request, but the removal of bodies and the preservation of relics was in the charge of an official of the road. The superintendent of bridges and the train dispatcher assisted in the work. Even Mr. Collins himself, the chief engineer, was there and worked in the water and forgot himself in the sympathy he felt. Throughout the day, the work continued, and the crowds passed to and fro. Men were employed who, in long rubber boots and waterproof coats, worked all day long in the ice and snow. It was a difficult and tedious task. The wind blew cold, the water was deep, the beams were heavy, the iron was netted together, and the wreck was embedded in the string. The bodies were frozen, they were packed among the debris and buried in the snow, but they were by degrees removed. Remains of men and women and children were taken by strangers' hands and placed in the rude deposits prepared for the occasion. This was under the idle gaze of many a spectator who had gathered there. The hands of friends were not there to lift the tender forms. Many of these were far away. Those who could have been there and whose every nerve and fiber cried out for their loved and lost were detained by the trains in the distant city. It's difficult for even the citizens who were present to realize what sacredness there was to these precious forms. Death had been robbed of its solemnity, and now it seemed a piece of business to remove the bodies which had burned. Friends had been purposely kept back that the revolting spectacle might be kept from their sight, or that some decent disposal might be made before they arrived. These bruised and broken and blackened things did not seem like human beings, and the sorrowing hearts alone would realize how sacred and precious they were, even in all their deformity. It was well that the shock was spared to many until the distance could be traversed. Yet it was an awful, shocking sight when the removal had been accomplished. It was a horrid thing to take these bodies and all their deformed and distorted shapes from their beds of ice and snow and iron and ashes and the coals of wood, but it was still more horrid to look upon them as they were gathered in that gloomy morgue. The freight house was turned into the place for the dead. Its doors were closed, and the darkness of a winter's day settled down in that cheerless place. It was cold and bare and gloomy, a fit place for death. As the sleds arrived from the deep gorge below, bringing the awful human freight, this large room was nearly filled with the ghastly rows. 36 bodies were arranged in boxes in a double line along the sides. A few had been taken out with their bodies uninjured, except as they had died from the breath of fire. These were placed by themselves upon the floor, and from their very attitude showed how awful had been their death. They were mostly men. There they lay with limbs disordered, with hands uplifted, with averted faces, and with all the agonized and awful shapes which death by fire must produce. One had endeavored to throw his coat over his face and lay with arms and coat above his head, caught by the flames and the shreds fixed in that shape. Another had twisted his neck and face away until the head rested upon the shoulders and back, and only the burned hair and whiskers could be seen. Another lay with limbs drawn up and body doubled, and yet his graceful shape and form could be read through the agony of death. Others seemed to have stood and held up beseeching arms and hands. With some, even the stumps of arms were outstretched as if in mute appeal. A few were drenched with their clothing on, but partly burned as if the water and the fire together conspired for their death. These all impressed the eve with the agony of death by fire, fear of such a fate, with that which the survivors felt the most. The agony depicted in these few distorted forms and faces showed how well-founded was that fear. But fortunately, there were but few. Not a dozen bodies were taken out that to any human appearance could have lived. This fire had been kept down. The rest were broken and bruised, or else their bodies had been completely burned. A more affecting sight was that of those who were placed in the boxes, broken and bruised as they were in every limb. The boxes could not contain them as their clothes were stiffened by the water and ice and snow. Those two, whose clothes had been burned away, were so distorted in limb and body that no box could hold their forms. Though dead and stiff and cold, they seemed as if they would start from their graves and escaped the fearful fate which had seized and destroyed their life. And yet even these would move the heart. They were those who somebody loved, and those seen in their distorted shapes and in that horrid place were dear to their friends and gratefully recognized. Some even impressed the eye with what they were in life. Strong men with enough of clothing left or with their form and features sufficiently preserved to show their gentle breeding or their business habits betokened through all the smoke and ruin what they were and how esteemed. Women, too, were there whose clothes were sufficiently preserved to show what taste and culture they may have possessed, and in their forms, though blackened and burned, retained to the grace and beauty which had been admired. Little child was there, beautiful in death, the delicate little foot hid beneath the closely fitted shoe, the nicely tapered limbs, the graceful, lovely form, the tasteful dress, the hands so tiny and so touching in their shape, one could but love the little thing. Even the stranger wanted to take that sweet, that precious child and clasp it to the heart. But no, that awful gash, that cruel blow had stricken all the beauty from the lovely face. Not the mother would kiss her darling child, she must press her lip upon vacant air, hoping that as she pressed that loved form to her aching heart, an angel spirit might catch the fond caress. There were other more revolting scenes than those, but let the veil be drawn. The deformity of death must not distress the living, and yet those were happy whose loved and lost had been reduced to ashes in that fearful burning, rather than that they should find their precious forms, for the sight would shock their very hearts, send back its warm affection to a chilled and appalled, a horror-stricken soul. No, the remnants of those deformed, defaced, and half-destroyed human forms were better in the hands of strangers than with their friends. The grim reality or certainty of their death, but the uncertainty as to whom the life belonged, were better with those who had less of the yearning for possession than the friends. Citizens could take up the poor remains when no one else could claim them, and could bury them with all the attention and kindness which was in their hearts, but no sense of possession was ever theirs. Therefore, they were happy who felt and knew that the sacred ashes of their loved had been covered by the beautiful snow, and the valley was their grave. The stream could sound their requiem, the lake could moan its lament, and every wave might be supposed to carry a portion of their precious forms to distant shores, but God alone could gather the elements and fashion it for the future love. Nothing but the sacred urn of earth, which contains all that is mortal of the human race, nothing but this is the depository of those love forms which were once so full of life, but everything in nature becomes the more precious to the longing heart. Unseen fingers shall weave their garments in the spring, and the songs shall burst forth from those forest hills. But the better land contains their spirits, and to that the living must go to claim their own.
It was 145 years ago, on a cold winter's night. Snow was blowing. The wind was blowing. When the number 5 train entering Ashtabula, Ohio, rounded the last curve, approached the Ashtabula Bridge, crossing the Ashtabula Gorge, when, with P.P. Bliss, the well-known gospel songwriter, and many others on board, felt the bridge below them collapse, and the train began to fall. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't realize, for many of them, this was their last moments alive. As the train plunged into the Ashtabula Gorge, 76 feet below, the train wrecked, falling into the gorge below. Screams were heard as the injured were hurt. Then the great fire, as the cars began to burn. The question was, why was not the fire put out? Many other questions were asked. Why did the bridge collapse? In this disaster, the most horrible at the time of the Ashtabula Railroad Bridge disaster, known as the Ashtabula Horror, the worst of its disasters at the time, find out as we research the details here on the Six Eyes Radio Network on December 30th. 2021, January 6, 2022, and January 30 and 13, 2022. Join us by calling 424-243-9617, 424-243-9617. Just press the number 1, join the conversation, and find out for yourself what happened on that most horrible disaster known as the Ashtabula Horror or the Ashtabula Train Disaster. Amen.
Wow. Wow, wow. That was interesting. That was very interesting to find out about that tragedy. And we just getting started. So I for one, enjoyed it.
Well, thanks, Dix. But you know what, honey? It's so hard for me to read that. I almost cried several times. But some of those people did live, and that's what I was blessed to hear. But I had read those two books, but I didn't, you know, read the whole thing. You guys would be on for lunch. But, you know, I tried to cover the top, you know, the main topics.
Oh, you did a great job. You did a great job. But what I don't understand is, though, why didn't they put the fire people just standing there just watching? I mean, that was the crazy part. And then for Robin, the deceased, that was just crazy right there. And then people trying to help people that's hurt, and they're still getting robbed. So that was just going to show you this world really needs prayer.
That's for sure, and that you hit the main points that are the real sad, and makes this the real tragedy. Is, I mean, it was bad enough that the bridge collapsed, but what really made it a tragedy? Here they had the fire engines on scene, they had the hose on scene, but the order was not given to throw the water. You wonder if the fire chief, who was known to be an alcoholic, given to liquor, was he drunk, you know? Or, as it says, as we went through, was it because the railroad officials, they allowed train wrecks to burn and they thought, well, if they put water on it, it would turn to steam? You know, what was the reason behind, you know, what was the real reason behind them allowing that to continue to burn? And then, like you went on to go on to point out, here the people, the survivors, here they're coming out of this, and then to end up with another tragedy, people trying to rob them and robbing the deceased. I mean, makes it even the more horrible. All right, Ruth, who else do we got with us tonight? Ruthie.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Who else do we got with us tonight?
Well, we have the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Band of Angels, you, M-Stag, Six, and me.
And me.
And Emily.
All right, Em, do you got any comments?
She might want to say something.
Excuse me. Ooh. I better quit yawning before I get Brother Six doing that tonight, and that wouldn't be good.
But any comments you want to make, Kim?
All I got to say is that was bad. It was bad enough, like Six said, it was bad enough that that bridge went. It was bad enough those people that died in it, and then the ones that survived, to actually get robbed after having something horrible happen was really bad.
Yeah, they took one guy's ticket for his next place. What are they going to do, take off with a ticket? I saw that in there, too.
Yeah, and like Rue just said, in the thing that was on tonight, even where it said that the one guy had a ticket to go on somewhere else, and they stole his ticket to go to wherever else he was headed.
And there was a lot of money stolen, too. That was in
and
there.
All that money and
yeah,
the stuff that was stolen. That was just totally uncalled for.
Yeah, and those people, I'm sure, will be judged by a certain God, I'm sure. But, you know, they'll never get caught.
But it's like this, like even Ruth just sat here and said, God will get him. We won't have to do nothing to them. They won't have to do nothing to them. The families won't have to lift a finger. God will get them when it comes their time.
Now you might have heard a guy
in the 1800s.
You guys might have heard a guy named Charles Collins. He's actually buried right up here at Chestnut Grove. And they say now that his body is in there. But they say he actually has a ghost walking around the cemetery. I don't believe it.
Now, Charles Collins was the conductor, wasn't he?
He was the engineer.
engineer. Okay.
Yeah, he was one of the main guys. He actually felt it was his fault. They said he tried to kill himself, but no. Later on, they found out he was murdered.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wondered if it had anything to do with the tragedy. Yeah, that's just unfortunate, and just go to show you that this happened in the 1800s, and people were still robbing. So just go to show you, people have been robbing since the beginning of time.
Yeah, well, what this happened, this was 1876. And Collins, 1876, and Collins, he was an engineer, not an engineer that runs a train, but an engineer that builds things, in this case, a bridge.
Oh, okay, okay. Wow.
So, and that's why he, when this bridge collapsed, he felt so bad that they, one, as we're going to learn later in the narrative, as we go later, we're going to find out that one group said he committed suicide, but yet with forensic science more in the modern day, asked the question, was it suicide or was it murder? And it looked like that it was actually murder, that he had been murdered.
Okay.
So we'll be getting into that later in the narrative.
All right. Well, for the group tonight, Brother Quick got a night off. My mother called into the show, so that was great. And it's just a interesting, informative way to end the last show of 2021. it's just an interesting way to end, because this is the last show of the year for Thursday. So
Six, was you one of those in the train wreck and got robbed? You couldn't get the year right?
So we're in 2021 going into 2022. My God. So, yeah, what a way to end the year. So this is our last show for Thursday in 2021 for this particular show. All right, I'm done speaking.
Yep, and the best part is we continue this series for the first two Thursdays of 2022. So you'll want to check those out and see what else happens. That's for sure.
Honey, I think Brother Quick was only on because he wanted to hear it.
Yep. That's for sure.
Yeah, well, he needed some time off. He needed a break. But like I said, it was very informative because, like I said, people talking, they never went into detail and said, they just said something bad happened, you know, and then I think I'd even mentioned it to you, and you told me, you know, this is how we got to this point right here, you know, with the train tragedy. But yeah, it's sad, but it's informative. Because, you know, you live in a city all your life, and then you never know the history. So this is some good, tragic, informative history.
You know, Six, that hospital was actually founded as a result of the disaster. It used to be called Asheville General Hospital. Now it's Asheville County Medical Center. And there's a recording outside in this little place where you sit. And you could actually hear the whole thing on what they call a kiosk. Did you record that, Kenny?
Yeah, but it's in a lot shorter narrative.
Yeah.
Then what we're doing here, we're doing a lot more detailed narrative.
We're sounding like an investigative reporter. We're trying to see what happened, yeah.
Yeah. So, but
hey,
with
it's
that.
It's the Six Eyes Radio Network. What do you expect?
Yeah. But anyway, what we're going to do, so that people could keep great shows like this one on the air, Six, would you give us some donation information?
Yes, yes, yes. Every donation we get, we definitely appreciate to help us keep us on the air and keep bringing you great programming here on the Six Eyes Radio Network. If you use the PayPal platform, the email address you'll enter is 6i6, that is S-I-X-E-Y-E-S, the digit number 6 at gmail.com. Once again, that's S-I-X-E-Y-E-S, the digit number 6 at gmail.com. Whatever God puts in your heart to help us keep bringing you great programming will be greatly appreciated. For those of you who utilize the Cash App, that would be $SIXEYES, the digit 2, the digit 4. Once again, $EYES, the digit 2, the digit 4. And again, whatever God puts in your heart to help us keep bringing you great programming will be greatly appreciated. This is the end of the year, so if you want to give a good donation before we get out of here in 2021 going into 2022, please do so. No amount is too big or too small. Thank you.
And then finally, Six, would you tell them how they could get a copy of this show and any other show?
Yes. For your smartphone users, if you go to your podcast app on your phone, in the search type in Six Eyes Radio, S-I-X-E-Y-E-S space radio, R-A-D-I-O. And once you search that, you'll see Motivational Monday. You'll see the Six Eyes Radio Network. In the top right corner, press subscribe, and you'll have all the Six Eyes Radio shows on demand whenever you want it. And this particular show, you can download, and you can download any of the shows on the Six Eyes Radio Network and have for your pleasure and listen to at your leisure. Thank you.
All right. And any final closing comments? We'll let you close us out, Six.
Well, once again, we want to thank you for joining us. Again, this was a tragic but informative story. And join us next Thursday, so we'll have the part two. And if you live in Ashtabula, why don't you all, you guys live in Ashtabula, why don't you have your friends call, and they can listen and be informed, too, about what happened in Ashtabula. You guys live there, so what better way to know some history on your city? So we want to thank you for listening. Once again, please, from the Six Eyes Radio Network, we're still in this pandemic, so please make sure you're washing your hands, wearing your mask, and practicing social distancing. I know New Year's is coming up, but if you can, stay at home. If you have to go out, please try to have it contained to a small gathering, not a big gala, you know, because we want you to be safe here at the Six Eyes Radio Network as we're still dealing with this coronavirus, Delta, and Omicron virus. So please continue to wash your hands, practice social distancing, and wear your mask. And if you're wearing reusable masks, please make sure you're laundering that mask. And for the disposable mask, please make sure you're not wearing it like a week, you know, like a couple of days, and then switch out. All right, we want you to be safe here on the Six Eyes Radio Network. Make sure you check on the elderly. If you have room in your house and you have an outdoor pet, if there is room where that pet can be inside, please, by all means, let that pet inside. If not, please make sure it has plenty of water, shelter, blanket, and hopefully a nice doggy bed. All right, thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Have a nice sleep, everyone.
All right. Good night.
Night.